All right, so have you ever thought about what happens when a doctor makes a mistake, but it ends up impacting someone who wasn't even born yet?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And actually, it's not just a hypothetical thought experiment.
Exactly. It's a very real legal dilemma. And it was the central issue in a Pennsylvania Superior Court case that we're going to dive into today.
Oh, this should be good. I love a good case deep dive.
Me too. And this one's particularly relevant for all of you law students out there because it really grapples with the idea of duty of care. Like, how far does a doctor's responsibility extend?
Especially when you're talking about someone who wasn't even conceived when the alleged negligence happened, right?
That's exactly it. The case is called Matharu v. Muir, and it's a fascinating exploration of how the law tries to deal with those long-term consequences of medical actions, even when those consequences impact people who didn't exist at the time of the initial act.
I'm already intrigued. Let's break it down.
All right, so let's start with the basics. The full case name is Baljinder S. Matharu and Jessica A. Matharu, individually and as administrators of the estate of Milan Singh Matharu, deceased v. Dr. Scott D. Muir, Dr. Fiorina Pellegrino, Hazleton Women's Care Center, and Muir OBGYN Associates, PC.
Okay, so we've got the parents, Baljinder and Jessica Matharu, and it looks like they're also representing the estate of their deceased child, Milan Singh Matharu.
Yep, and on the other side, we've got the defendants, Dr. Scott D. Muir, Dr. Fiorina Pellegrino, Hazleton Women's Care Center, and Muir OBGYN Associates.
Got it. So where and when did this all go down?
This was decided by the Superior Court of Pennsylvania on February 21, 2014.
Okay, so relatively recent case. And you said the core issue here is about a doctor's duty of care, right?
Yeah, the big question the court had to grapple with was whether the physicians involved owed a legal duty to Milan Singh Matharu, even though he wasn't conceived when the alleged negligence took place back in 1998.
So we're talking about actions that have consequences years down the line, potentially impacting someone who wasn't even a thought in anyone's mind at the time.
Exactly. It really makes you think about the ripple effects of medical decisions. But before we get too deep into the legal weeds, let's step back and understand the human side of this case, the actual events that led to this legal battle.
Okay, let's hear the story.
So our story begins with Jessica Matharu. She has Rh negative blood.
Ah, that's an important detail. For our listeners who might not be familiar with blood types, could you give us a quick rundown of what that means and why it matters in this case?
Sure. So when we talk about Rh negative blood, what we're really talking about is the presence or absence of a particular protein on the surface of red blood cells. If you're Rh negative, like Jessica, you don't have that protein. Now, this becomes especially important during pregnancy.
How so?
Well, if an Rh negative woman is carrying a baby who's Rh positive, meaning the baby inherited that Rh factor protein from the father, the mother's immune system can actually see the baby's blood as foreign.
Oh, I see. Like an invader needs to fight off.
Exactly. And the mother's body can start producing antibodies against those Rh positive blood cells. The problem is, if she gets pregnant again with another Rh positive baby, those antibodies can cross the placenta and attack the baby's red blood cells.
That sounds pretty serious.
It can be. It's called Rh sensitization, and it can lead to a bunch of complications for the baby, including anemia, jaundice, and even brain damage.
So what can be done to prevent that?
That's where Rojam comes in. It's a medication, specifically an injection of antibodies, that's given to Rh negative mothers to prevent them from becoming sensitized.
So it essentially tricks the mother's immune system into not seeing the baby's blood as a threat.
Precisely. It's a pretty routine part of prenatal care in these situations, and it's been a huge game changer in preventing these kinds of complications.
It sounds like it.
Yeah.
So where did things go wrong in Jessica's case?
Well, back in 1998, during her second pregnancy, she was under the care of Dr. Muir and Dr. Pellegrino at the Hazleton Women's Care Center. And for whatever reason, she wasn't giving the Rogam injection after delivering her son, Sandeep.
Oh, wow. So that's the alleged negligence we're talking about.
That's right. As a result of not receiving the Rogam, Jessica became Rh sensitized. Her body started producing those antibodies. Fast forward to 2005, and Jessica is pregnant again, this time with Milan.
And because she was already sensitized, this pregnancy became high risk.
Exactly. Sadly, Milan was born extremely prematurely at just 26 weeks. Because of his mom's Rh sensitization, he was severely anemic. And tragically, just 2 days after he was born, he passed away.
Oh, that's just heartbreaking. I can't imagine what the Mathers went through.
It's an unimaginable loss. And in 2007, they filed a lawsuit against the doctors and the healthcare providers involved, alleging wrongful death and survival action.
So that brings us back to the core legal question, right? Did those doctors owe a duty of care to Milan, even though he wasn't even conceived, when they allegedly failed to give Jessica the Rojam?
Right. It's a really tricky question because in 1998, when the alleged negligence occurred, Milan wasn't a person in the eyes of the law. He was just a possibility.
But then again, the purpose of Rojam is to protect future pregnancies. So in a way, you could argue that they were negligent towards any future children Jessica might have.
Absolutely. And that's precisely the argument the Matherus made. They pointed to the restatement, second of torts, specifically section 324A, to support their claim.
Okay, now we're getting into the legal nitty-gritty. For our law student listeners, can you give us a quick explainer on what the restatements are all about?
Sure. The restatements are basically really influential compilations of common law principles put together by a group of legal scholars called the American Law Institute.
So they're not law themselves, but they're highly respected interpretations of how the law works.
Exactly. They're often cited by courts in their decisions. And in this case, the Matharis argued that Section 324A, which deals with liability to third parties for negligent undertaking of services, applied to their situation.
Meaning, even though Milan wasn't a patient at the time, the prenatal care Jessica received back in 1998 was an undertaking that should have included protecting her future pregnancies, including the one that resulted in Milan.
Precisely. But the defense came back with a pretty strong argument of their own. They pointed to Pennsylvania's MCARE Act, which has a 7-year statute of repose for medical malpractice claims.
Ah, the statute of repose. That's a key concept in this case. Can you explain that for our listeners?
Of course. So a statute of repose basically sets a firm deadline for filing certain types of lawsuits, regardless of when the injury actually occurred or was discovered. In this case, Pennsylvania's MCARE Act says that you can't sue a healthcare provider for malpractice more than 7 years after the alleged act of negligence.
So the defense was essentially saying, look, the alleged mistake happened in 1998. The lawsuit wasn't filed until 2007. That's way past the 7-year mark. Case closed.
Right. So now the Matharis had two major legal hurdles to clear. They had to convince the court that the doctors actually did owe a duty of care to Milan, even though he was unconceived at the time.
And they had to get around that statute of repose, which seemed like a pretty solid defense.
Right. So how did the court tackle this? Well, first, they looked at the question of duty of care, and they placed a lot of emphasis on that restatement section 324A that we talked about.
The one about liability to third parties for negligently performing services.
That's the one. The court essentially said that when a doctor undertakes to provide prenatal care, that undertaking isn't just limited to the mother.
It also extends to the foreseeable beneficiaries of that care, which would include future children.
Exactly. And the court really honed in on the specific purpose of Rojam. It's not just about protecting the current pregnancy. It's about safeguarding any future Rh-positive pregnancies.
So given that, it's really hard to argue that harm to a future child wasn't a foreseeable consequence of failing to give Jessica that Rojam injection.
Right. It was like setting a chain of events in motion that could have a very predictable and potentially devastating outcome. The court also distinguished this case from another one that the defense had cited, Siebold v. Prism Health Services.
How was that case different?
In Siebold, the connection between the alleged negligence and the injury to the third party was much more indirect and remote.
But in Mathuru, the negligence happened right smack in the middle of an existing doctor-patient relationship with Jessica.
Exactly. And that relationship was the foundation for the duty of care. It wasn't some random act. It was a failure to provide a standard of care within a specific professional context. The court also shot down the defense's claim that Dr. Meir couldn't be held liable because he wasn't the one treating Jessica when she was pregnant with Milan.
That seems like a bit of a stretch.
It does, doesn't it? The court recognized that the initial failure to administer Rojam back in 1998 was what set everything in motion. It was the root cause of the harm that Milan ultimately suffered.
Makes sense. So the court was pretty clear that the doctors did owe a duty of care to Milan. What about that statute of repose? How did they get around that 7-year time limit?
To address that, they relied on a pretty important legal distinction. They pointed out that the initial negligent act, that's failing to give Rojam back in 1998, wasn't the same thing as the actual injury, which was Milan's death in 2005.
Oh, so they're separating the act from the harm.
Exactly. They said that even though the clock for the statute of repose usually starts ticking from the date of the negligent act in a wrongful death or survival action, it's the death that marks the injury.
So they're saying that even if the negligence happened years ago, the legal clock doesn't start until the actual harm occurs.
Precisely. So in this case, the 7-year period started running from Milan's death in 2005, which meant the Matharis' lawsuit in 2007 was well within the time limit.
Okay, that makes sense. And what about the issue of causation? Did the court find that the doctor's negligence directly caused Milan's death?
Absolutely. They had no trouble establishing a direct causal link between the failure to administer Rogam, Jessica's sensitization, and the complications that led to Milan's premature birth and ultimately his death.
So they covered all the bases. Duty of care. Check. Statute of repose. Got around it. Causation. Crystal clear.
Right. They built a pretty solid legal argument.
Mm.
So for all the aspiring lawyers out there, what are the big takeaways from this case?
Well, first off, this case is a textbook example of how the restatement, second of torts, particularly Section 324A, can be used to hold someone liable for harm to a third party, even if that third party wasn't around when the negligence initially occurred.
And it really highlights how crucial it is to understand the difference between a statute of repose and a statute of limitation.
Right. One is tied to the act, the other to the actual injury. And that can make a huge difference in a case like this, where the harm doesn't manifest until years later.
This case also gives us a great glimpse into how courts grapple with new questions of duty of care. They have to weigh all these different factors, like foreseeability of harm, the severity of the injury, the burden on the defendant, and the social utility of what the defendant was doing. It's a balancing act.
Absolutely. And there were a couple of quotes from the case that I thought were particularly powerful. One was, "The duty of a physician extends to those within the foreseeable orbit of risk of harm."
Yeah, that one really drives home the point that a doctor's responsibility can reach beyond the immediate patient in front of them, especially when their actions have the potential to cause harm down the line.
And this one, too. Section 324A circles back to the original undertaking here, the physician-patient relationship for treatment.
That's a good one. It shows that this duty to a third party isn't coming out of nowhere. It flows directly from that initial relationship between the doctor and the patient and the services the doctor was supposed to provide.
I think that's a great point to wrap up on.
I agree. So for all of you future Legal Eagles listening, Matharu v. Muir is a must read. It shows how the law is constantly evolving to address new situations and how the concept of duty of care can stretch beyond those directly involved in a doctor-patient relationship.
It also underscores the importance of understanding foreseeability, those ripple effects of actions, and the role of statutes of repose in medical malpractice cases.
It's a powerful reminder that medical decisions can have long-lasting consequences, and the law has a responsibility to grapple with those complexities. And it leaves us with a pretty big question to ponder. If a doctor's actions can have legal consequences for someone who doesn't even exist yet, what does that say about our understanding of medical liability and the rights of future generations? It's something to think about.
Definitely a lot to chew on. Thanks for taking us on this deep dive. I always learn something new from these cases.
Me too, and I hope our listeners did as well. Until next time.